Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
You might have worked for all of your adult life, saving for your retirement, putting money away in a pension. And now inflation is devaluing all of that effort that you put in for decades. That should anger everybody to their core.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. We are going to discuss all things finance, but today we're really going to discuss all things precious metals, silver, then gold, maybe then some macroeconomics. We got to talk about where we are in this particular stock and credit bubble cycle because of the potential impacts on gold and silver pricing. Now, it's been really just a huge, almost like 10 years since I've talked with Dave Russell, CEO of Goldcorp, last, because so much has happened. We have gold and silver, at least, on a critical minerals list, and China's putting export controls on it, sort of, and there's things going on. Prices have been going wild. Silver went to 54. Oh, no, it collapsed back to 48. Now it's back over 50 again at the time of this recording. Here we are to help us decode all of this. Dave Russell. Dave, so good to be talking to you again.
Likewise, Chris. Help to decode. We'll make our best attempt to decode what's going on. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, well, I like to, you know, I'm a big picture guy. I like to start at the outside end. I definitely want to get your insights into what's happening from your perspective. You got your finger right there. You're watching the pulse and flow of silver and gold because of your business. And but I want to back up a bit before we get to that view of it. And I want to talk about these silver shortages. And it starts with this, that red area there represents now 6 years of structural silver deficits, meaning demand was above supply. And supply consists of two big pieces. One is mine output, and the second would be recycling, they call it, or stuff that's coming back into the market. It could be grandma's silverware. It could be recovered from other purposes. And as well, there's what we'd call investor demand. People like myself, yourself, or people who buy SLV or other things are actually creating that. But anyway, those three sources of demand, industrial, and investment, those two big sources, exceeding supply. That seems like a pretty big deal to me, and this was going to catch up with us at some point. And I think we're here because somebody mispriced silver too low for too long.
That's right, and that's one of the kind of fundamental problems with the silver market, is that the silver price was so low for so long. And what that meant is silver was, there was little or no investment in silver mining. Silver is generally mined as about 70% of it is mined as a byproduct of other metals. It's mined in places where zinc and copper are mined predominantly. The big producers are like Chile, Peru, Mexico, Russia. So you've had underinvestment in mines for so long. One of the reasons it's been underinvestment is because the price has been so low. And so the supply is very inelastic. In order to increase the amount of supply, not only do you need to obviously invest more money into the mining market, but there's a whole prospecting that goes with it. There's a whole permissioning that goes with it. There's much more environmental issues now opening up a silver mine and getting the various different licenses. It's a slow and expensive process. So it can take years for new mines and new mine supply to come on stream. And then also because there's been underinvestment in existing, if you look at the silver mining shares, we're only kind of getting back now to the levels that they were at, you know, exceeded in 2012. They've been going sideways for such a long time. So there wasn't that much interest in investing in that sector. So there hasn't been the investment going into it. It's been underinvested in for so long. It takes a long time for it to get up and running. So the supply side of it is very constrained. I mean, it comes from, the supply side is predominantly, you know, it's silver mining output, and it's recycling. And I've been doing a lot of kind of thinking about the recycling over the last couple of days, coincidentally. And back in the kind of Hunt Brothers era, when we last saw silver run up to these levels, we've exceeded those now, but, you know, they're thereabouts, recycling was much more predominant. But that's because if you think about the inflationary effect on the dollar in the intervening years, $50 silver was worth significantly more than $50 silver is today. So there was a massive motivation to actually recycle grandma silver in comparison to today. So it's not as easy. And if you go along with grandma silver, and it's sterling silver, 92% pure, and you try and cash it in, there's very few places that you can do it. And you'll probably get about 50% or less of the silver content value of it. So you're, you know, again, the motivation is not there, which is totally different to back in the Hunt Brothers era. At $50 silver was approaching real money. So, you know,
Dave, I just calculated it. I just punched it in. That would be $50 in 1980 is $208 today.
Wow. Well, there you go. There you go. And even if you're only getting 50% of the spot price, there's, you know, 100 and whatever dollars an ounce. You know, you'd be jumping at that. Mm-hmm. But you're not going to be jumping at $25 an ounce. So they're the two, the two parts of it, you know. And obviously it's not, you know, there's industrial recycling as well. There's not just grandma silver. But there's, it's inelastic, effectively. And what you also have... we talk about investment. We talk about it as a demand side. It's also a supply side because it's people selling their investments back into the market. And at this moment in time, a lot of the people that are investing in silver are not willing to part with it at these levels. So they're looking for significantly higher prices before that investment demand moves back into the market. I said this on a podcast recently. I said there is actually there's no shortage of physical silver. I was standing in a vault, and I know it was only one vault, but there was three in this location that I was at in Switzerland, and it had about $700 million worth of silver just sitting in front of me there in one vault, and they had another two of those vaults. So I know that's even just small in the greater scheme of things, but that was all 1,000-ounce bar format, and it was all sitting there, and you could see the names of the various different funds on it that own those. That's all silver that's waiting to come back into the market at some stage at higher prices. So there is physical silver there, right? Because if there was, and that comes in, you know, that comes in as when people are looking to liquidate. Maybe some of that silver has been held since it was $5 an ounce. But that's another supply side factor that comes in, but that's very price dependent.
But that it comes and goes. So it's a weird thing I found is that, you know, when I was talking to some of my retail silver gold seller friends, and they said that once silver hit 42, that was a psychological moment, because I think that was the peak in 2011. A lot of people waited for that moment. I'm even, baby. They came rushing back in, and they were swamped. And then a week later, when silver was at 48, all these people, not maybe the same ones, but are coming back in saying, yeah, I want silver now. And yeah, it's got a very weird market dynamic when it goes through those price spikes.
Yeah, it does. It's very much that kind of, you know, if you study economics, what was it? The Giffen good, you know, demand rises with higher prices, and silver very much falls into that because it comes on the radar of a lot of people, and particularly because it is, in the eyes of a lot of people, has done nothing for a long time. I mean, forget when I joined the market, it was $5 an ounce. It's now over $50 an ounce, so it has done something. But for a lot of people who got into it the last time it came on the radar in a big way, which was in, you know, 2010, 11, 12, you know, it really went sideways for a decade and a bit after that. Now it's coming back on the radar. It's just, you know, it's pushing its head above the parapet, and people are noticing it. So they're now saying, oh, okay, yeah, now silver's now making its move. But these things never go in a straight line. You know, anybody who's sat in a trading desk knows that they don't go in a straight line. And they break the new all-time highs, they'll have a little bit of a rally, and then they'll pull back down to the last breakout point at least. And that's, you know, it's the idea of strong hands, weak hands, short-term traders versus long-term traders. I see, primarily because the fundamental balance between supply and demand, that this is a market that is set for some multi-year moves, let's put it that way, multi-year bull market.
It's a great point. I'm not a trader. And I used to trade gold futures, so never silver. That was Too much of a widow maker, it looked like to me. A penny is a big move, right? You know, it's can wipe you out quick at my scale. So at any rate, but trading is not my thing, but investing is. And so I believe in the long-term fundamentals. I've been holding silver. My first purchase of silver was $4.53 an ounce. And,
nice.
And that was 100-ounce bars from a place called Academy Mint. I don't even know if they exist anymore. And the reason I did that was because I was like, wow, I could see this mismatch between what I perceived to be the value of that. That was way back in 2001. Now I think it's something much more severe because here's some big things I want to talk with you about. First, we talked about, okay, this is a very big supply-demand mismatch, and you said something important. 70% of silver, nobody's mining it. It's a byproduct, mostly of copper and zinc mining. Well, when you wander over to the copper mine side, same story. It's been underpriced for so long that new copper mines are just not being opened, explored, all that, because like you said, it's a very expensive, sometimes decade-long process. No money, just hemorrhaging money the whole time. So guess what? Last analysis I read that copper has to be twice as high as it currently is for anybody to even begin thinking about going through that process. So the base mine supply is shrinking at this point in time, right? And we have to make that up with just straight up silver mining. Again, that's just a piece of the puzzle. And didn't I hear that Mexico put a moratorium on new silver mine leases? Did that ever transpire?
Yeah. I mean, it's a fascinating market. It's a fascinating investment case as well. Whether you look at the supply side or you look at the demand side, I think one of the things that we always have to remember when it comes to silver as opposed to gold, and I think people misunderstand what's said when, you know, people say it's used in industry, it's consumed. It's not that it is, its form changes in such a way that it can no longer be used, but it tends to be used in industry. And I give you, say, a mobile phone, for example. Each mobile phone uses about probably somewhere between 25 and 40 cents worth of silver, right? It's a tiny amount, but it's something like 1.5 billion mobile phones made each year. So that adds up as about a couple of hundred tons. But it's in such a small amount that the cost and the energy to recover 40 cents of silver from a mobile phone is too great to make it actually economic. So it ends up in landfills, for example. So it is dispersed across the, you know, a globe in dumps and landfills and other places. So it's not recoverable in the same way, and it's not recoverable economically at current prices as well. So therefore, as with gold, all the gold that's ever been mined in the world still exists in one form or another. Silver is a different animal. So on the demand side, it has this it has this fundamental that's taking metal out of the market, and until that effectively becomes economically viable to recycle, is gone, and a lot of that may be lost to, you know, maybe lost to time effectively. So it's a fascinating supply demand fundamental argument when we talk about the investment case for it. There are so many, you know, whether you talk about on the supply side, so you got problems with recycling, as we talked about, you got problems with mine supply, so they're the two big ones. But you've also got you've all of the investment silver that's sitting on the sidelines that people are speculating for higher, investing for higher prices. That's not coming back in, and then you have the flip side of that is the increased investment case, which means that more of that has been taken out of the industrial available silver and kept on the sidelines. You've got massive amounts of industrial applications in silver. The whole kind of greening of the world, the electrification is a big silver story, whether that's in solar panels or just electrification in general. The use cases for silver are growing all the time. It's, you know, used in medical devices. It's used in, you know, there's applications in batteries now. So not only is the usages of them increasing, but the demand within certain ones, like the photovoltaic cells, is increasing massively. So on both, it's not just a supply side story, it's a supply and a demand side story. So the underpinning fundamentals of the silver market have a huge investment case supporting them.
Indeed, they do. Very well said. Dave, we're going to hear now from one of our favorite supporters out there. And when we come back, I want to talk about what I think is a third element of demand that you and I haven't talked about yet. We'll be right back. Hey, folks, Chris Martinson here. Look, we've all been there watching our hard-earned dollars get chewed up by this endless inflation machine, while the folks in Washington and the big banks continue to play games with our money like it's Monopoly cash or something. It's not right. I know it, and you know it. The trust in the system? It's eroding faster than a sandcastle at high tide, especially with all the geopolitical storms brewing. Now, I've been saying it for years. You gotta protect yourself, your family, from all this nonsense. That's why I personally turn to gold and silver, the real deal, physical stuff that you can hold in your hands under your control, not some digital promise that could vanish overnight. Everyone should own some. It's just common sense in times like these. But here's the thing. When I need it stored securely, away from prying eyes, I use Goldcorp. They're the ones I trust. They ship it right to your door, really quick if you want to hold it in your hands, but also if you prefer, they can stash it in top-tier vaults in places like Switzerland or Singapore or right here in the United States. Your call, your metal. And for you, my friends who follow Peak Prosperity, they'll hook you up with the first 6 months of storage absolutely free. That's how much they value real people like us. Buying and selling? Hey, it's as easy as trading stocks, but way better. Because with Goldcorp, you're the sole owner. Fully allocated, fully segregated, in your name only. No sharing with strangers, no funny business, no security entitlement nonsense. Need cash fast? Sell in seconds at market price? Want it in your hands? Hey, one click and it's shipped. They've got everything from coins and bars to allowing for self-directed IRAs, all locked down and secure. It's simple, it's safe, and straightforward. Take charge of your future, folks. Don't wait for the system to fail you any further. Head over to peak.fan/goldcore. That's peak.fan/goldcore right now and claim that free storage. You won't regret it. I sure don't. Welcome back, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that, Dave. How about this, though? Because this is brand new for us. The U.S. has now officially added copper and silver to what it calls its critical minerals list. Okay, bothers me because they're metals. But Russia's done this. China's doing this as well. So hoarding, or what I would call responsible inventory management, seems to be something that might be on the radar screen now.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. starting a silver reserve, basically, a strategic reserve in the same way that, as you know, oil is a strategic reserve. And I think really what's happening here is the increasing investment case and that supply-demand fundamental imbalance is coming onto the radar of people who are, you know, are looking at their needs over the next 10, 15, 20, 30, 50 years and saying, okay, well, if we don't actually have a strategic supply of these minerals, we're going to be at a significant disadvantage to the countries, world powers, that do have access to this. And as I said, like, you know, particularly when it comes to silver, the, you know, some of the big producers, Mexico, Chile, Peru, but also Russia. You know, and Russia has talked about effectively attempting to monetize silver and putting it, you know, having it as a reserve asset on balance sheets. So, yeah, again, this is an additional demand side fundamental story.
Well, it's been growing for a while. I mean, it's what a slow motion disaster or awesome investment opportunity from my perspective. I mean, I honestly, I think strategically, my country ought to have a strategic silver supply amongst several other things. You just should, because it's critical. And if there's one thing that we learned from the drone warfare happening in Ukraine, the wars have changed. It's now battery operated. The highest density battery you can get in the world still to this day for its weight is a silver oxide of some kind, silver magnesium or silver manganese, something like that. But you might need it for warfare, but you might need it for all these other things you just mentioned. It's medical, it's electronics, it's all these things. Because silver's not substitutable in several applications, right? It's a very magic substance. So it is what it is. So anyway, we see that demand side growing, but I can't vouch for this. First off, I didn't know this top part that at least the boiling water nuclear reactors, the Westinghouses, they consume a lot of ounces of silver. I don't think this is as true of the small modulars, but to the extent people are still building the big ones, the big nukes, they consume a lot of silver. We know nuclear is a huge story going forward, but then this person writes, well, the supply nightmare 2025, they say here, could be history's first year where 100% of mine output goes to industry. And that would be a new thing. And is that unreasonable? Well, maybe not. SRS Rocco report here showing that, you know, it's just more. Every, 2016, it was about half. 2015, it was half. 10 years later, it's 86%. Could it go to 100%? Well, it could, right? And we know that because of solar panels in particular, just consuming more and more and more. So this would be 350. I think we're doing about, that's what, 370, and we're doing about 820 right now. So 45% of total mine output just for photovoltaics.
Yeah, it's scary. Now, if you go back to the second last chart there, all it takes is the last two columns for that trend to continue, and you're going to hit that in the next couple of years easily. As I said, the applications are increasing of silver, but also is the demand for those individual applications. So the photovoltaic cells demand is skyrocketing and is expected to continue to do so over the coming years. So yeah, 100% mine output, not inconceivable at all. And then where do you get your silver from? Well, you know, maybe you're waiting 10 years for a new lot of silver mine supply to come on or investment to come into the market and to develop out existing mining assets. But more than likely, where a lot of that silver is going to come from is from the various different investment vehicles, whether it's just 1,000-ounce bars sitting in a vault or whether it's the SLVs, the ETFs, whatever it is. And the only way that actually happens is with significantly higher prices.
And as you said, you know, if silver goes from $50 to $100 an ounce, from an investment standpoint, it's like, oh my gosh. But from the cell phone standpoint, it now goes from 20 to 40 cents to 40 to 80 cents per cell phone. It's irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. Exactly. It's used in such small doses in things like mobile phones and in a lot of various different electronics that if you have the doubling, tripling, like, okay, so it goes up 10 times. So it adds, what, $3 to the price of a manufacturing of a mobile phone? We're not going to notice that. And the same for a lot of electronics. The things that use, you know, greater quantities, whether that's the nuclear reactors, whatever, they obviously become significantly more expensive. I saw that tweet as well the other day, and I was looking at it, and it was not something that was on my radar as much, the usage in the nuclear industry.
Yeah, me neither.
But it also struck me that as with the micro doses of silver used in mobile phones that are unrecoverable, I'm quite sure that used in nuclear reactors, that they're not as easily recycled either. So
yeah,
I mean, again,
probably. Understatement. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's another consumption, let's call it, that's off the market for usage for a good number of years. Yeah. And if we see an increase in nuclear reactors, again, that's another demand side fundamental that's driving this market. For me it's a fantastic investment case all around.
Well, I'd love to talk to you about so for a long time silver and gold and many other things are priced either in London or New York, right? And silver in particular is really priced in London and New York as well. But I think London is the heavy on the physical side. New York is maybe heavy on the paper side. So that's how they sort of played it off for a while. It feels like that baton of price setting has sort of passed. And maybe it's not entirely out of the hands of the West, but they don't have the only hand on the baton at this point in time. And I've been noticing that it feels like there's this one-way trip. I love Bai Jiajun is constantly telling us what's in the silver vaults at the SGE and the SHFE. And this is the first time that the vault at the SHFE fell below 600 tons, because that's 1,000 kilograms is a ton. So below 600 tons, and it's just been every day he posts this, these are red numbers. I've been watching this for a while, and this is what it looks like over time. They hit a high of 3,000 tons, and now we're all the way down to just under 600 tons, and that, I mean, it, you know, it was nowhere in 2016, took on a lot, but now it's hemorrhaging it again. That feels pretty important to me, Dave, that this silver goes into the official vaults in China and then it leaves. Yeah. Where's it go?
Yeah.
I think it goes into the hands of people who just got burned in a real estate savings misadventure, and they're defaulting back to their old cultural standby, which is precious metals.
Yeah, whether it's being done officially or not, it's effectively remonetizing gold and silver. People are just really understanding the destruction of currency, of fiat currency, how it's impacting them in terms of inflation, the fact that so many economies, major economies around the world, have got massive deficit problems, and they have tried to print their way out of these problems for years. That was always a case of kicking the can down the road, and now we've actually got to the end of the road and there's all the cans sitting there waiting for us. And it doesn't work anymore. It doesn't work anymore. And we're starting to see inflation tick back into the system at the same time as we've got, we're cutting interest rates in the US at the same time as you've got, all-time highs in stock markets, for example. There's an understanding that effectively the value of paper currency in your pocket is being utterly destroyed. Regardless of what we're being told through official channels, we know we go out to the shops and try and spend our money, and it doesn't buy us anywhere near what it bought this time last year, let alone this time 5 years ago or 10 years ago. We know that the inflation rate is significantly above the official claims. And most people are starting to ask the question, what can I do about this? If I've got money sitting in the bank and it's going to have the same, it's going to be affected by the same, have the same impact of inflation. Well, okay, grand. What's the value of that this time next year, or this time 5 years time? Yeah. Where do I want to put that? Do I want to put it into more paper-based assets? I mean, we've got stock markets at all-time high. They're ultimately just paper-based assets. There's somebody else's promise to perform a duty at some stage in the future. Do I want to put them in bonds? Well, we look at the problems with the deficits. We look at the problems with the national debts, and it's bonds are somebody's promise that, yeah, I'll fix this. You know, we'll be able to keep this going for another couple of years and repay it. Or do you want to actually shorten the distance between you and true wealth, which is physical, tangible assets that are highly liquid in the form of gold and silver? And that's what people want. Trust is disappearing. And when trust disappears, you want to shorten the distance between you and wealth. Gold and silver is true wealth. It's final settlement, effectively. Cash is just, fiat currency. It's not final settlement. It's just a way to keep the game going. Gold and silver is that final settlement. It's wealth. You can look at it. You can point it. You can hold it there in your hand. Nobody has to perform a duty in order for it to hold value. And the reality is that when other people, when everyone doesn't perform a duty, which happens, we've so many times throughout history when they don't do that, and that's governments, that's companies, that's bankers, when they don't perform their duty, gold and silver react positively. So everybody is losing faith in the system. They're losing faith in the paper-based system, and they're losing faith in the people who are issuing those promises. And they're saying, well, I don't want to have my wealth at an arm's length. I want it in my hand. I want it close to me. Because the only thing that that's what I trust. I trust me and my metal. I trust me. I want to hold it. I want to have it, because I'm fed up watching everybody else that's meant to fulfill obligations and promises fail to do so over and over again.
Well, I did want to talk about this inflationary aspect, because what's inflation? Inflation is somebody failing to perform their duty, unless their duty is to print too much money, in which case you get inflation. And I think that it looks to me like, Trump came in under high hopes, as far as I was concerned. We're going to get this Doge stuff. We had an extra $2 trillion to spend that got tacked on because of COVID. And oops, it's kind of hard to get it back out of there again. But he was going to, and then they just threw in the towel on the whole thing. So we had a 2025 fiscal deficit of $1.775 trillion. Looks like it's going to be higher than that. Trump is saying on top of this, maybe he's even going to give that $195 billion custom duties back. as stimmy checks to the U.S. citizens. So we're already talking about stimulating, but the economy's great, but here's some money anyway. It's just getting, it's getting a little awkward at this point. It feels like, to me, the big seven stocks are going up. They're obviously in bubble territory. Their capital expenditures cannot possibly be justified under current revenues. That is the very definition of a bubble or a malinvestment. Underneath that, Chipotle, restaurants, you know, FedEx, freight. We have this other
real
economy.
Businesses.
Yeah, it's just like swan diving away, and then we're being gaslit and told the economy's never been better, but here's $2,000. I put all that together, and I think that I can read the headlines for myself and the subheadlines. We're at a very perilous point here in the United States, at least from a recessionary standpoint, which makes sense because they happen, you know, yeah. And here we are.
Yeah, I have a slightly different way of looking at inflation. And I remember being at your event back in early October, and this came to mind. It's like, if what inflation really is to people, it's the devaluing of the blood, sweat, tears, energy, life force that you put in to earning that money in the first place. So you might have worked for all of your adult life, saving for your retirement, putting money away in a pension. And now inflation is devaluing all of that effort that you put in for decades. That should anger everybody to their core.
Because it's a theft, right? It's an unelected, unvoted theft. Somebody's decided in some boardroom somewhere, the FOMC meeting or wherever these meetings are held, that the productive output of my entire life ought to be whittled away because they need it for other purposes.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
And those purposes, surprise, turn out to be making sure that the 0.1% wealth assets, financial assets, go up in value year after year. That seems to be, I know they care about that. I'm sure they care about that. I'm not sure if there's any other concern below that registers. Full employment and stable prices. Nah, it's not, those mandates are not actually part of something they care about. But I think
they're
like,
they're kind of buzzwords that are, you know, kind of thrown around, stable prices, you know, and you know, what are stable prices? It just means that I know that what I buy this year will cost me the same if I buy it next year. And that if I get a raise because I perform better at my job, or I get a bonus, or as I get older and I'm just worth more to the company, I earn more money, that we have stable prices. I'm able to be rewarded for my effort. I can buy more stuff. I can support my family better than I could before. Stable prices is not a, you know, it's not nothing, you know. It's a genuine expectation. It's a genuine expectation. And again, it's something over which control has been exerted. And it's a tool, it's another impact outcome of having your time, effort, and energy and lifeblood devalued.
Well, and the Fed's throwing in their own towel, right? They used to say, oh, 2%. I still disagree that you should have any inflation target whatsoever besides zero, right? Hmm. In fact, I could make a stronger argument it ought to be below zero, because we get better and more productive and more efficient at things. Actually, prices should fall, not rise, but that's me. But anyway, their 2% target, they're at 3+ officially. You and I both know you have to tack whole numbers onto that to get to reality. And they've said, oh, well, I guess we're going to have to cut. And I guarantee you, we are not that far away from more quantitative easing at this point in time. They're going to have to print more, too. We all know it's coming, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the quantitative tightening has finished, and now we're going to be going into quantitative easing again. I mean, there's talk of it. And here we are, as you said earlier, you know, stock market's an all-time high, and being told that the economy has never been better and that the US is the hottest country in the world right now. Well, okay, you're cutting interest rates, inflation 3%, the target is 2%. With my maths, that's 50% above your target. we've seen this before, how quickly it can tick up. The last time it ticked up is when stimulus checks were posted out to people, and now we're in a situation where we're thinking, okay, well, maybe we might need to. There's total incongruence. The story isn't straight. Put it that way. The story isn't straight. When the story isn't straight, there's generally something else happening.
Yeah. Well, I was really taken with this, that, you know, history sometimes more than rhymes. Torsten Slok out of Apollo Wealth Management, put this and said, hey, you know, obviously, you know, there's this weird sort of similarity between the 70s inflation, which is in the blue line, and then this current bout of inflation in the green line. And could it turn up again? So the second inflation mountain we had there from 78 through 82, that happened because of, well, there was energy inflation, and also there was monetary and fiscal policy errors. I think you and I just talked about the monetary and fiscal policy errors that are, like, we're repeating this. We're doing this again, right? And in no small measure, you know, there's two parts of inflation. One is just the obvious impact of too much money being thrown into the whole thing, right? But the second is people's expectations. So I think when people have just come out of inflation, you and I, if it starts to tick up again, you and I and millions and billions of other people will not hesitate to understand that inflation is coming back again, so we'd be well advised to spend our money sooner than later, which adds to the inflationary fuel.
Absolutely, it does. And if you want to ever think about these things, always take them to extremes and see if you have any examples of extremes. Well, you do Weimar Republic back in the 1930s, where people would be coming home from work at lunchtime to give their pay packet to their wives. I'm not being sexist, but it was generally the men working and the wives staying at home back in the 30s, giving their pay packet to their wives to go out and spend it and buy the groceries in the middle of the day, because they knew that the prices were going to increase further by later in the afternoon. So that, again, what does that do? That increases inflation. And so you're exactly right. If there's a fear of inflation, what do you do if you think that the prices are going to be significantly higher this time next year? You buy it now if you've got the cash. What does that do? It starts to drive the prices higher. So it becomes a self-perpetuating situation. So yeah, totally agree, John, that one.
I think you were talking about the early 20s.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is, I love whoever put this chart together, because, you know, it's like, we're coming into 1918, and look, gold was like 1 to 1 for the German mark, right? And it goes to 10, and people are like, oh, it's overbought, and for a whole 6 months, it goes backwards, and if you bought there, you felt like a complete, just an animal, you just did terribly, and then it goes up again, but oh gosh, it's going nowhere, Dave, look, it's going nowhere, whole year, goes nowhere, oh, okay. Gold is effed, you know, oh, that's the end of that. And then, uh-oh, no, it's going to collapse here. Whoop, off we go. And note, this is on a log scale, right? So this is crazy. So it went from 1 to 1 trillion paper marks in 5 years, but it's notable there was a lot of action along the way. There was some real significant price collapses. If you were levered long gold right there, you might have gone bust, even though you'd made the absolute winning bet. The point I take from this is you grab on when you see the trend starting and you hang on for dear life.
And Weimar Germany is always the one that's used in examples, but it's not the only one. You know, we've had Hungary, we've had Zimbabwe, we've had Venezuela, we've had so many instances of this, that once a government central bank loses control of their currency, there's no stopping it. And I always use that as a reference when people start saying, what's the appropriate allocation to gold in my portfolio? Well, in benign times, that might be, you know, 3%, 5%, 6%, 7%, right? But it all depends upon your appetite for risk, but also your perception of risk. So I say, what was the appropriate allocation to gold in a portfolio in 1920s Weimar Germany? It was 100%. Mm-hmm. You know, it was 100%. So depending upon your perception and what's happening, there's no one size fits all in this. And as we start to see governments starting to lose control of their currency, the allocation to gold should increase, because effectively what you're saying is not the allocation to gold should increase, but my allocation to cash should be tending towards zero.
Correct. And, you know, when I was surprised that it takes Wall Street forever to get around to the gold story, because I don't think they can quite get their raccoony fingers into it deep enough for their taste. So they tend to poo-poo it, and they have for a long time. But I just saw a big investment house recently go from a 60-40 stock bond to a 60-20-20.
Yeah.
20% allocation to gold. Well, what would that mean? You know, Ergon von Greyers here out of Gold Switzerland says biggest wealth transfer in history from paper to real assets, noting that, you know, here, Dow Jones to gold, this ratio, it's very volatile. But if you'd want to hold gold here, you're going to, like, this is just going to continue down until basically you get to that one-to-one weighting, which is 1 ounce of gold will buy 1 unit of the Dow. Today, that's around 42,000-ish, but it'll take time to get there. My comment to that is, because people are like, gosh, gold's overbought, it's overbought. It's not, Dave. It's still extremely under-owned. If we think about that 60-20-20 portfolio, I ran the numbers. I said $128 trillion of financial wealth held principally by the top 10% in the U.S. with a current 2% weighting. What would it take for them just to get to 5%? And the answer is about an additional $5 trillion of investment pouring into a gold market that in the U.S. is, I don't know, maybe $2 trillion-ish. Mm.
Yeah, I know. It's a really interesting story. There's a number of ways to kind of slice and dice that as well. I think it was Morgan Stanley in the 60-40 portfolio.
I think that's right, yeah.
So, but the 60 is equities, the 40 is bonds. And now they're saying 60 equities, 20 bonds, 20 gold. And you go, okay, well, that's, first of all, that's the gold side of that, which is 20% into gold. That's new. I haven't heard that before. But what they're saying is sell half your bonds. So the big investment houses in the US, their advice to most of their clients is to sell half their bonds. Now, what does that actually mean? What does that suggest is a severe lack of confidence in the monetary system, in the bond market? And if you lose confidence in the, if your big houses in the US are losing confidence in the bond market, that's a significant signal. And they weren't alone. I think it was Bank of America decided, instead of it went from their 60-40 to a 25-25-25-25, which is 25, I think it was 25 equities, 25 long bonds, 25 treasuries, 25 short-term treasuries, and 25 gold. So this is a story that is, this is a philosophy that is gaining traction as well as everything else. And it, again, as the your numbers there in terms of what that means in terms of metal and money moving into that market. And if you think about it, if that amount of money was to move into stock markets, yeah, it'll have an impact, but it can be absorbed because more shares can be issued. It moves into the bond market, it can be absorbed because more bonds can be issued. They're paper-based assets. There's no limit to how much can be created. But if you've got that amount of money going into a physical, tangible asset, you can't print more gold. So the arbiter of this trade is price, and that's significantly higher prices. And if we look at it, if we compare that, or look at it through the lens of that Weimar Germany graph there, and you're saying, okay, well, why would anybody buy gold at $4,000 an ounce, or $5,000 an ounce, or $6,000 an ounce, or $7,000, $8,000, $10,000, whatever it is? Mm-hmm. Because if faith in the monetary system continues to be eroded, and we're looking down the barrel of something like this, that's an argument of, you know, the 10-to-1 mark there versus the trillion-to-1 mark at the top.
Yeah, and there's another big, big thing under all of this for me, which I'd love to hear your take on this, which is, oh, so in blue is gold. This is closing in on the dollar on global reserves. So this is sort of official gold, not you and me. This is banks, big central banks. But from 1980, which, remember, we went off the gold standard for people listening, August 15th, 1971, and that was the U.S. doing that, but we were the world's anchor at that point. So we kind of, the whole world came off the gold standard at that point. And so then they spent the next 20 years trying to pretend like gold wasn't money. They sold it. They had these London gold pools. They had the Washington agreements. You had people famously, like the Banks of England and Canada, stepping out and selling their gold at like historic, shameful lows. did everything they could, and then gold was just not money. Look at this. We're at the 10% mark. And then it starts to rise a little bit here. And this means gold is becoming money within the system again. And would you look at that on a dollar basis? This was early 2025. Look what's happened just recently.
Wow. Wow.
They've topped out U.S. treasuries at this point in time. It seems like a big deal to me. This is a remonetization. Quiet, stealthy, slow, but it's happening. Gold's being money again.
Gold is all, it's always been money. People just forgot what that meant. And in that period, you know, we had the 80s and in the 90s, and particularly in the early noughties, we had very low benign inflation. We had a lot of technological advancements, which contributed to the benign inflation. In that environment, it was easy for people to forget that gold was money. But now we're moving into a different era, a different inflationary era. The ability of central banks to continue to kick the can down the road has gone. And now people are just starting to remember what gold is money is all about. So it's always been money. There's just a new generation of people who have to actually learn what that actually means.
In the West. The East, I don't think, ever forgot.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There's been that gold buying culture in the East, in China, in India, for generations, for centuries. They understand that. We lost that. We've lost mm-hmm. that in the West. And you know, we bowed down to the mighty dollar for many years, and we've not understood that ultimately the final settlement for all of our wealth, money, is gold and silver.
And because they didn't forget that, I'm sort of reminded of Hemingway's famous aphorism about how did he go broke, you know, slowly, then all at once. Look at the Shanghai gold futures exchange gold inventories, these futures exchange gold inventories. I mean, it's just, we're kind of at the all at once stage. I think China quietly for the past, and I had articles I wrote about this, Dave, back in 2015, 14, because I was noticing this flood of gold from west to east, right? These kilo bars would get recast in Switzerland principally, and they'd disappear. And later on, the import and export numbers would tell you it all went basically east to China. And they did that quietly for a long time. I think we're at the not quiet phase of this story.
Yeah, exactly. I think they're shouting about it now. So they're only shouting about it now because they have reasons that they want to shout about it. Officially China's meant to have, 2,200 odd tons of gold. Exactly. It's laughable. Yeah. They've been buying up gold. They've been buying up mine supply. They've been buying up doré for a long, 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 long time, bringing that in and refining it. They've had this very long term plan, to reduce their exposure to the dollar. To take back control effectively of their trade currency, which they haven't had for a long time. And this is their mechanism for doing that. They created the Shanghai Gold Exchange. They created what is the Gold Corridor, which is effectively Shanghai Gold Exchange vaults in a number of different currencies, or countries rather. And those countries are countries in which they do a lot of trade with, that will allow those countries to trade in yuan and then effectively convert their yuan to gold as and when they want to. They're remonetizing gold. They are creating a monetary system that will rival the dollar based system. And it's a huge story, and it is one that is going to gain traction over the next year. And people are really going to start to understand it. I really think when you look at that graph and you see the dramatic increase, that's not somebody coming up with this idea a couple of weeks ago, you know, or this time last year and deciding they're going to buy lots of gold. This is a signal to the world that this is what we're doing. And they've already got the infrastructure in place. They've already got a lot of the gold there. I think we will learn soon over the next couple of years that China's the biggest holder of gold in the world. And second to them will be the Chinese population as well. So you've got a really, really, really strong, sound money, monetary system that will emerge in the East, and that is going to threaten the monetary systems of the West.
Well, I agree, and this is again maybe I'm just don't have the right frame on this, but it bothers me a lot that Trump's current strategy for negotiating with the world is to bully them. Right, do what I want, or I'll tariff you, or we'll crush you. And he warned the BRICS countries that if you dare to put gold into your system, I will crush all of you. Right. That's one way. But I think what China's doing is the other way. It's a different way of going about this, because you said the most important word there is when it comes to money is trust. And you can't force trust on someone. You can't yell at them enough to create trust within them. Right. It just doesn't work. So China said, don't trust us, trust the gold. So they've set up a place to convert yuan into gold, both in, I believe they did this in Hong Kong, and I think they've done it as well over in Saudi Arabia. So that's like sort of the Reagan-esque trust but verify. Like, hey, you know, let's do trade. We're all going to be good. But if you need to, sidle on up and yank your gold out of these places where we've set up for you to do that. That creates trust to me. Yeah. So I feel like we're being just absolutely end-runned in the game of money, which, again, it's not that hard. You have to have trust. You trust. It's one of the reasons I'm going to get in a lot of trouble. I always get yelled at when I say this. But people have told me, Chris, you just haven't studied Bitcoin hard enough. I'm a pretty smart guy. I study it, and I don't know what's happening with it the bit layer down there in the machine language. Like, I don't, I have to trust that something's happening there that can't be hacked or broken or compromised. And I don't have that trust because I don't trust anything electronic at this point, you know? Okay. But that's me. And I need trust to be part of it. Like you say, when you have an ounce of gold in your hand, all the trust is right there. Everything else, including gold that's held by somebody else or in storage or is in a different country, you know, you're going out the trust ladder a little bit, right? Hmm. To some extent. But you have to have that trust for money to operate. The only trust I have in the U.S. dollar is that I trust it's going to be worth less next year than this year.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. There's just one thing that I'll comment on there, just in relation to China. I think that they got to a stage where they realized that they could not make progress because they accepted and publicly said, okay, we understand you don't trust us, so trust gold instead. And effectively, they then said, okay, well, who's going to hold the gold? Oh, well, we'll hold the gold. And they went, okay, not really too comfortable with that. Okay. And then they start creating this gold corridor across the countries where they're doing trade mostly with. So they are trying to remove the need for trading partners to trust China, because they know that people, they've finally kind of publicly accepted that people don't trust them, and this is their way to establish trust in their trading currency.
Seems reasonable to me, right? And if it works, it'll work fine. I think it's going to work fine, personally.
We'll see.
Well, I think it's going to work fine because China's a manufacturing powerhouse, and they have things that other people want, you know? So I can make a case for bilateral trade. China has a lot of needs of things they want, and other people have things they want. Hey, it's just trade, right?
Yeah, I mean this is a big bold move. You know, this is a significant time in history. The changing of our monetary system, effectively, or at least to begin with, the monetary system used by half of the world. That's huge. That is really, really huge. We'll look back in, you know, they'll be reading about this in textbooks in. They won't have textbooks, but they'll be reading about this in history class.
Yeah,
you know, in the years to come, this is a huge moment in time. And the reality is that the chances of the dollar reserve system going quietly into the night are very thin. So it won't be without its consequences.
No, it's. I imagine it would come with huge consequences. Right? This is how wars get started, obviously.
Yeah.
You know, because this is power. Exactly. That's what
this
it is.
This is a power. Absolutely. This is a power struggle. You know, and we're going to be moving into a, you know, moving away from what has been a fairly unipolar world for a while time, for a while now, to into a multipolar world. Those things don't happen peacefully.
Yeah. Well, I've run into precious few people in the United States officialdom who really seem to understand money as a core concept, not you know, as power. I think they get it, but I mean, you know, money should be a store of value, a unit of exchange, a medium of exchange, right? A unit of account, medium of exchange, right? It should have some characteristics. I don't think there's anybody who gets that. The closest person I've seen is Judy Shelton, who was considered briefly for a Fed role. You know, I know she gets it, right? But that would be astonishing to me to have people in a position of authority inside the U.S. government or financial system who understood what money actually needs to be and how to get there. I don't think we have it.
I think they do. I think they do understand it. But it's about ending the party. This is what's made them rich for many decades. And they will fight against it. They've done everything they can to fight against it, and they've colluded with the, you know, institutions and banks to fight against this. I think they really do understand what sound money is, but sound money takes power away from the authorities and gives it back to the people. You talk about the, you know, store of medium of exchange, a store of wealth, all of those characteristics of money. That puts power back into the hands of the people. Because as we talked earlier about the idea of inflation, and inflation being devaluing all of your blood, sweat and tears, that all the effort that you've put into earning that money over the years, and that quietly gets stolen from you through inflation. Well, it is stolen from you, but it ends up somewhere.
Where'd that purchasing power go?
Yeah.
It went somewhere.
And sound money stops that. So I think I 100% believe they do understand the concepts of sound money, but have kept it under wraps for many, many decades as they perpetuated this fractional reserve dollar reserve system that has benefited a very, very small percentage of the population, the political elite, the 1%. And I think that, you know, that they're getting to a stage where they go, we can't get away. We've lost control of this. We can't get away with it for any longer. And not only that, but we've got China over here in the east that's coming up with this, the Shanghai Gold Exchange and the gold corridor, and that's going to be. It's not only is it going to be a threat to our monetary system, but it will hold a mirror to our monetary system, and it will show all of the weaknesses, and it will show that if this works the way that it is intended to work, that sound money exists in the east, and they have the protection of purchasing power. They have the store of value at the same time as having their medium of exchange. It will just be seen to work better. And that will show up the cracks in the current system in the West. And they know this is happening, and they know that the game is up at this stage. I firmly believe that they know exactly what they're doing.
Okay. I mean, one does not just simply hot swap over from a defective debt-based infinite fiat money system to a sound money system, right? That would be, I don't know, like trying to replace both wings on a plane that's mid-flight, you know? It would not be without consequences, as Dave Russell says. But if the U.S. dollar is a 24-hour, you know, story, how close to midnight are we?
That's a good question. You know, and for many decades they've managed to add minutes on to that day. I think we're past 5 to midnight. I think definitely we could be an awful lot closer, but I never want to underestimate their ability to find a little bit more road to kick this can down. That's the thing. There'll be there'll be some wonderful magical thinking that will just extend it just a little bit longer. But I think the cracks are there, and they're just big enough that we're very, very close.
Good. Well, we'll leave it there unless you have any final words, Dave.
Ultimately, you know, we live in a financial system. We're born into a financial system. We transact in a financial system. We buy and sell everything in our life through that financial system. We've lost touch with the meaning of money. We no longer spend it in the same way. We hold our phones up to other devices to transact and move our wealth to somebody else. We're like the fish who's the last to understand what water is. We've been born into this financial system. We don't realize it, and we don't appreciate the fact that ultimately we can vote to take some or all of our wealth out of that financial system by investing in gold or silver, and literally saying, I'm not playing your game. I'm not playing your game anymore, or I'm not playing your game right now. And depending upon how much risk that you perceive in the market, how close that clock is to midnight, will determine what your appetite is for and your allocation for precious metals. But that's your ultimate way to take your wealth out of the financial system.
Well said. So we've been talking with Dave Russell, the CEO of Goldcore. You can follow them. You got a really good channel over on YouTube that's going. Maybe tell people about that and where they can follow you.
Yeah, that's Goldcore TV. You can find us on Goldcore TV on YouTube. We put out a number of videos each week. My colleague Jan Squiles hosts that. She does some really, really good analysis on that. We also do a lot of interviews with industry experts on that as well. So subscribe. Jump on over there, watch a few videos, and if you enjoy it, subscribe.
Absolutely, do that. All right, well, Dave, thanks so much for your time again today, and let's do this again soon.
You're so welcome. Cheers, Chris.